You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
For the first time in 2017, we're talking Cardinals baseball today, Wednesday, the 4th of January, with our Cardinals reporter, Jennifer Langosch. And Jennifer, a pleasure as always. And Jen, I think kind of the big news where the Cardinals are concerned right now doesn't really involve the Cardinals per se, but we just had the Winter Classic, the NHL Winter Classic at Busch Stadium. The Blues defeating the Blackhawks 4-1, so another Chicago-St. Louis rivalry game. This time, though, not the Cubs and Cardinals, but rather on the hockey end of things, the Blues and the Blackhawks. And for you, how much of a front-row seat did you get for the transformation of the stadium from baseball stadium to hockey rink, and how much of a role did the Cardinals themselves have in this entire transformation?
Yeah, this was really a thrill to cover as a baseball writer who never gets to cover hockey, to kind of merge the two worlds together. But I went over to the ballpark middle of December, I believe it was around December 15th, and that's when really that transformation started. The NHL rolled in with more than six or seven tractor trailers full of equipment, a refrigeration unit that is top of the art so that they can create the rink that they did, that can withstand and withhold any sort of weather conditions, which we saw come into play with some rain and mist early on in the game on January 2nd. But, you know, it really took the NHL less than 2 weeks to build this rink, which ran from first base to third base. A very neat design in which they had a guitar kind of running up the middle, which was a nod to the history of the Blues in St. Louis. And then just the buzz that surrounded this event in St. Louis was really neat, the buildup going into it, the alumni game they had a couple days in advance, and then obviously the Winter Classic on January 2nd. But this was really kind of a coming-together opportunity for the Cardinals and the Blues, and it wasn't lost on anybody, the symbolism there. It's been almost a year now since the Rams of the NFL left for Los Angeles, and in that time we've seen the Blues and the Cardinals really try to do a lot together in this community. This was an effort by both organizations to get this Winter Classic to St. Louis, the Blues, thinking that it'd be an opportunity to highlight their fan base here, and the Cardinals seeing it as a chance to display their stadium and bring the two organizations and their rich history together. So a very, very cool event. Sold out crowd, of course, with the St. Louis Blues winning. I think that was a little bit of a cherry on top. And it wasn't lost on folks either that the three months to the day that the Cubs and Cardinals will open their season at Busch Stadium, we had another Chicago-St. Louis rivalry game going on at the ballpark.
Yeah, you got to love the symmetry there. And no matter, you know, how many times I watched the Winter Classic on New Year's Day, or in this year's case, the 2nd, of January, always, you know, the scenic shot of the stadium and the rink right in the middle of the ballpark, it never ceases to awe me, and I think that a lot of fans would share that same sentiment as well. You know, is at the same time, though, is there ever any concern from strictly from a grounds crew perspective that, I mean, you know, for a couple of days, a baseball stadium undergoes a complete makeover? Is there any lingering, you know, effects from, you know, when the event's over to getting Busch Stadium back to optimal conditions, you know, in preparation for baseball season? Or have they got this whole thing down to such a science that that's really not a concern these days?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there's much of a concern there. The Cardinals, separate of even this Winter Classic coming, were going to resod their entire field this offseason. So everything had already been pulled out really shortly after the season ended. And then that process of putting down the new grass and the new dirt will begin then once the NHL packs up all of its equipment later this week and rolls out of town. So, you know, the Cardinals here at Busch Stadium the last couple years have gotten really good at figuring out how to host other events, along with obviously, you know, using the ballpark for its main purpose, which is to play baseball. But the concerts that they have, the soccer games that they've hosted, and those coming during the season, they've been able to really transform things very quickly. And so with 3 months now to work with in order to get that new grass in place and growing, I think it'll be a pretty seamless effort. And from what I've heard from Cardinals officials, there's no concern that it won't be ready by April 2nd.
And that's great news for everybody involved. And, Jen, I don't know how much of a hockey fan you are, but the one thing that struck me is kind of the reverse symmetry, if you will, between the Blues and the Blackhawks and the Cubs and the Cardinals. Now, obviously, before the Cubs won the whole thing in 2016, you know, for years it was St. Louis garnering, you know, championship after championship, and the Cubs were the long-suffering fan base. But that's flipped in hockey, where it's Chicago They've won 3 Stanley Cups in, I think, a 7-season span. And the St. Louis Blues, despite a number of appearances in the Stanley Cup final, they've never won a cup. So is there as much of an intensity between the Blues and Blackhawks side of things as there is between the Cubs and Cardinals? Is there some parallel there?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry is probably still kind of another degree is probably over what we see with the Blackhawks and the Blues. But these are two teams that, as you mentioned, maybe don't have the same Stanley Cup history, but in recent years have been very competitive and have played each other very frequently in the postseason, which is kind of a difference from the baseball rivalry in which it was, you know, 2 years ago was the first time that the Cubs and Cardinals had ever met in the postseason. So, you know, of course, it was the Blues last year that knocked off the Blackhawks in the playoffs. Years prior, it had been the Blackhawks that it had stopped the Blues from trying to make their sort of run. But, yeah, I mean, the Blackhawks have the Stanley Cup trophies that the Blues want so much. It was funny. I was listening to Sports Talk Radio after the event, and somebody was asking, you know, what big event now that St. Louis has hosted the Winter Classic, what can we host next? And the consensus was, we want a Stanley Cup final here. I mean, it's really the one thing that this city hasn't been able to enjoy. And amid all the Cardinals' success, I think maybe gets lost how much of a hockey town St. Louis can be. And certainly if this team is able to make a run, whether it's this year or in the coming years, I think would certainly maybe highlight that on a national level to more of a degree than we've seen thus far.
Yeah, I mean, they're a popular pick every single season to, you know, not only reach the final, but finally win a Stanley Cup, which they've never done. Maybe this is the year when you got a guy like Vladimir Tarasenko wearing your sweater. You know, you certainly can't count out the St. Louis Blues. Maybe 2017 is the year they get that done. To kind of wrap up the Winter Classic discussion, I know that Blues goalie Carter Hutton, he didn't play in the game. Jake Allen got the start and he got the win. But explain how Hutton, he got a rather awesome gift in the mail from one of the greatest baseball players to ever live. Kind of take us through that.
Yeah, so Carter Hutton, as you mentioned, though he didn't play in the game, he did have a mask, a goalie's mask, designed specifically for this game. And if you look at the image of the mask, he really brought the Blues and the Cardinals together. He had an image on his mask of Ozzie Smith doing a backflip. He also had an image of Stan the Man Musial, obviously the greatest Cardinal ever to play here in St. Louis. That image made its way to the Musial family. They were so moved and touched by it that they actually sent Carter Hutton a Stan Musial signed baseball, which he found in his locker, which was obviously in the Cardinals clubhouse for the game, the day before the Winter Classic. So even though Carter Hutton didn't get the memories of playing in the Winter Classic, he was smiling from ear to ear going home with a Stan Musial autographed baseball. Again, really just kind of a symbolism of all that these two organizations did to come together for this. There were other Blues players that took advantage of being in Busch Stadium and went to take a little batting practice in the indoor cages. They really embraced the opportunity to kind of step in another athlete's shoes for a day. But I would say that Carter Hutton with that same usual autograph baseball probably made out the best of everyone.
Yeah, I think no matter what he got for Christmas, a Stan Musial autograph ball would trump everything. So not a bad day for Carter Hutton, despite not playing, to get that as a gift. You know, like I said, not a bad day at all. Jen, just to wrap up here, some actual baseball talk. Gee, what do you know? Matt Carpenter was offered a spot on Team USA for the upcoming World Baseball Classic, which is coming up in March. But as far as I know, he has yet to give a response. Do you think we're going to see him suit up for the Stars and Stripes? And when do you think he's going to make that decision?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I wouldn't be surprised if this decision is going to come down to playing time. And, you know, we have to remember that the players that are participating in the World Baseball Classic are also, you know, simultaneously trying to get ready for the season. And it's no secret that Matt Carpenter is a big piece on the Cardinals team. And he realizes that. So, I mean, if you look at the players that have already committed to Team USA, and you see some of those infield spots lining out, I wouldn't be surprised if Matt Carpenter is in discussions with Team USA, just asking, you know, how much would I play? Where would I play? I think what makes him a really appealing pick for the club is his versatility. I mean, this is a guy last year we saw make 40-plus starts at first base, at second base, and at third base. He could fill in as a corner outfielder if needed, puts together a very professional at bat. So there's a lot of reasons why Team USA would want him to participate, but I think Matt Carpenter wants to make sure that he'd be able to get a sufficient number of at bats that he's not going to end up feeling like he was shortchanged getting ready for the season. But I would think a decision in that is coming soon. We expect to see Matt Carpenter here in St. Louis in about 10 days for the Cardinals winter warm-up, and certainly he'll be asked at that time, and I would bet that he'll probably have a decision made by then.
It's a tough balancing act. I know a lot of guys want to represent their countries and play in a special event that comes around only once every 4 years, you know, a la the Olympics. But at the same time, you are under contract to your team. You want to prepare for your team and, you know, to get into spring training and to get acquainted with your new teammate, Dexter Fowler, to have that two-headed monster at the top of that lineup. That's going to cause a lot of agita for opposing pitching staffs in the NL in 2017. I think we can all agree on that. Jen Langosch, always a pleasure. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals. For the first time in the new year of 2017, we're talking Pirates baseball today on this fourth day of January with Adam Berry, our Pirates reporter. Adam, thank you as always for the time. And clearly, Adam, the Pirates had no consideration whatsoever for our podcast schedule because after we did all of our holiday content before 2016 closed, they then signed Ivan Nova to a 3-year deal, $26 million. So how dare they? Hopefully they have more consideration for us in 2017. So to backtrack a little bit, let's kind of break down this deal. As I said, 3 years at $26 million, and you know, these days that's a pretty reasonable price tag. How shocked were you, or were you shocked, that they were able to get Nova back in a Pirates uni for that amount of money?
Yeah, not terribly shocked that Nova came back to the Pirates in general. I think he was being completely realistic and honest when he said at the end of the season, even after his last start, actually, at PNC Park, that he did not want to leave that clubhouse. He liked the team. He was comfortable there. He was at the point of his career where he just kind of wanted to settle in a little bit. You know, he'd been with the Yankees throughout his career, and he wanted to, you know, basically keep that continuity going if he could, not have to deal with the whole changing uniforms and cities and clubhouses every couple of years. But the price tag was kind of surprising. I think, you know, when he was talking about an extension at the end of the season, the reports were his agents were asking for 5 years and $70 million. I think most people predicted he would get at least 3 and 36, which was the Jay Happ deal we've talked about, or 3 and 39, the former Francisco Liriano deal. But to see him get 3 and 26 with, you know, it could go up to 3 and 32 in the end, I believe it is. He's got performance bonuses up to $2 million per season, but that's still a pretty discount deal considering what starting pitching is going for in this market right now. So I think Nova kind of stayed true to his word that he wanted to stay in Pittsburgh, and the Pirates, you know, weren't just messing around when they said that they were still engaged and hopeful to keep Nova.
Now, you know, 3 years and $26 million kind of suggests that, you know, there weren't any other teams, or at least many other teams, in the mix to acquire Nova's services. Is that kind of what you feel about this and why the Pirates were able to get him back for just over $8 million a year?
The interesting thing about that is that his agent, Greg Genske, went on MLB Network Radio about a month before Nova signed and said they had contract offers in the range of that Jay Happ deal, 3 years and $36 million. Nova actually declined to comment about this when he was on a conference call with reporters to announce and discuss the signing, but I guess it's still possible. Hopefully some more detail will come to light, you know, as Nova reports the spring training, and we get to talk to him a little bit more there about his market. But I think what it suggests more than anything is just that he really wanted to come back to Pittsburgh. I mean, certainly this is a guy who could have at least tried to wait out the market. You know, he signed and late December, he could have tried to wait into January or early February and see if a deal would come his way for a little bit more money. But I think it does also show maybe that, you know, the market is maybe correcting itself just a little bit. We have seen some pretty wild deals out there. I think last offseason, Mike Leake signed for something like 5 and 80. He's basically been a durable but league average roughly starter throughout his career. And, you know, that's more or less what Nova's track record is. And you see the difference between, you know, 5 and 80 from the Cardinals and 3 and 26 from the Pirates. So I think it's a good deal for the Pirates, and Nova seems happy, which is really all that matters for him. So it seems like both sides kind of got what they wanted in the end.
Yeah, the ultimate win-win proposition here. And, you know, let's be real, he's not going to struggle to pay the rent, you know, pulling in a little over $8 million a year. But at the same time, given the exorbitant contracts that you brought up, especially in the case of Mike Leake, to get a guy of Nova's caliber for 3 years and 26, that is definitely a steal, you know, all things considered. So good deal for Nova, great deal for the Pirates, and hopefully both sides are happy and will be productive in 2017. So Adam, transitioning, if you look at the rotation right now, and I think that before Nova came back in the fold, the two locks in that rotation were Cole and Jameson Taillon. Throw Nova in there as the, you know, projected number three starter. When you look at the last two spots that, you know, the team is looking to fill, the four and five starters in this rotation, whose stock was hurt the most by Nova coming back? You know, who might get squeezed now that there's two open spots instead of three?
Yeah, it basically makes a competition, essentially for an official competition for two spots, but more likely it's just going to be a competition in spring training for that last spot. We've said all along their biggest need was a number three starter. It looks like Nova will be that. The number four starter is most likely going to be Chad Kuhl. That's kind of what Neil Huntington and Clint Hurdle have said throughout the offseason. Kuhl made his debut last season and was probably the most consistent of the non-Taillon rookies to make their debuts in 2016. He does a lot of things the Pirates like, you know, gets a lot of ground balls, is really competitive. So he's the most likely, you know, you can kind of pencil him in. The other three are in pen. Chad Kuhl is in pencil. And then beyond that, at this point, you would have sort of a four- or five-way competition for that last spot involving Tyler Glasnow, their top prospect, Stephen Brault and Trevor Williams, two other prospects who made their debuts last season, and Drew Hutchison, who was the Pirates' return in the oft-debated Francisco Liriano trade. The Pirates are also going to stretch out Wade LeBlanc, the veteran left-hander. He's more likely to end up in the bullpen, but just another name to kind of throw in that competition. So, you know, that is what they have in-house right now. A lot of options. Nick Kingham is a guy that doesn't get talked about a lot, but, you know, he was once a top 100 prospect, according to MLB Pipeline. He's on sort of the Jameson Taillon track. He could be ready by May, possibly even June, you know, depending on how his return to AAA goes. You know, he's got sort of a mid-rotation, you know, profile, so he's a guy who could help them out at some point this season, which is why it's not imperative that they go out and get another starter, even though it seems like the fan base right now is pushing for them to go out and get one starter in particular.
And that starter would be Jose Quintana, I believe, from the White Sox, as they are in full rebuilding mode. They dealt Chris Sale in that blockbuster to the Red Sox. They've made some other big moves. They got rid of Adam Eaton. But in terms of the rotation itself, you know, after seeing what they got back for Sale, they're thinking, well, we could get back something fairly similar for Jose Quintana. I know there was a lot of buzz a couple of weeks ago before the new year regarding, you know, Quintana to the Pirates and what would it take. I think that's died down a little bit, but is this still a possibility? And if so, how strong of a possibility?
I think it's still a possibility, just in the sense that, you know, Quintana is still on the White Sox and the Pirates haven't filled out their rotation yet. You know, it's a hard kind of match to find just because, like you mentioned, the Chris Sale deal was a really, really big cost in terms of prospects. And, you know, the Pirates, there's not a lot of precedent for them doing that, especially under Neil Huntington. They have not really moved any top-tier prospects, and it would take, let's say, at least two of them to make this kind of deal, plus some additional young talent along with that, you know, kind of package. So it's hard to see the Pirates doing that, but Quintana is such a unique pitcher who would fit their, you know, fill their needs basically in a lot of ways. He's under club control for 4 years at this point. His contract is incredibly affordable. He's a top of the rotation type arm who a lot of people don't really recognize as being such because, you know, he throws 200 innings every year. He's a, you know, three ERA kind of guy. Really, he would go a long way toward bolstering the top of their rotation. If you look at Nova as sort of that mid rotation kind of guy, if you could roll out a group of Cole, Quintana, Taillon, Nova, and Chad Kuhl, all of a sudden you're looking a lot more competitive in the National League Central, you know, against the Cubs who aren't going anywhere and the Cardinals who have kind of retooled and reloaded this offseason. So, you know, it's hard to find that deal. Are they really going to give up somebody like Tyler Glasnow plus and Austin Meadows or Josh Bell or Mitch Keller or Kevin Newman, you know, along with some other guys? That's really hard to see, but you know, guys like Quintana aren't made available all that often, especially at the rate that his contract allows right now.
Yeah, it would be tough to part with the guys that you mentioned, especially the Glasnows and Bells of the world. But boy, oh boy, that rotation you just mentioned, I'm not even a Pirates fan, and I was excited hearing those names. You know, like you said, Cole, Taillon, Quintana, Nova's your number four, Chad Kuhl, your number five. I mean, wow. that, in my mind, could be a top five rotation in baseball and get the Pirates right back into contention in a very tough NL Central. Adam, to wrap up here, we mentioned Josh Bell, and he's one of my favorite dudes. After his outstanding performance in the Channing Cage this past summer, which I had the pleasure of hosting, he's taking some measures to get even better and more awesome for 2017. Talk about the areas in particular that Mr. Bell is focusing on.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. It's kind of reflective of the maturity that a lot of these Pirates prospects show when they get up to the big leagues. I think it was really obvious in Jameson Taillon, and you're going to start seeing it really clearly as Josh Bell gets a little bit more comfortable. He was at Pirate Fest, and we talked to him, you know, the usual, how's your off-season stuff going? And he's basically just talked about he's already looking at ways that he can last, you know, kind of prolong his career. He talked toward the end of the season with David Freese, who's a veteran guy, and Freese told him, you don't want to get in a slump in the off-season. So I thought it was really interesting. Bell has been doing, you know, yoga. He's been doing spin classes. He's dropped about 10 or 15 pounds. He's been taking swings on a heavy bag in his garage in Texas. Just a lot of sort of hard work in the off season, and especially in the early part of the off season, just basically already focused on how he can improve after a pretty solid debut going into 2017. So he's been working at first base. He's already had at least two sessions with some of the major league coaching staff. He worked with Kevin Young as a special assistant, and Joey Cora, the new infield coach. Just a guy who's very clearly willing to put in the work and do it in a smart way, because it's not always about working hard, it's about working smart, and it seems like Josh Bell is really willing to commit to both. So that's an encouraging sign as the Pirates head into 2017, within sort of beginning, you know, his run is sort of the everyday first baseman.
Yeah, big things ahead for Josh Bell. We saw him scratch the surface in 2016, but boy, sky is the limit with him, and with his talent and work ethic, which not every player has. He could really reach some new heights here in 2017, no question. Adam Berry, we've reached new heights yet again on our Pirates discussion. Thank you so much for the time. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Pittsburgh Pirates. For the first time in the new year of 2017, talking Brewers baseball today on this January 4th with Adam McKelvey, our Brewers reporter. Adam, thank you as always for the time. And, you know, we're kind of in that lull period right now. You know, between the holidays and the start of spring training. And I know that because it's that lull, it is kind of a popular time for fans to kind of flood the inbox with questions. I know you get many of those from Brewers Nation. So, Adam, with that in mind, what question or concern are you hearing the most from fans as they look forward to what they hope is a bounce-back 2017 season?
Well, I actually wrote about this right before the holiday after clearing out my inbox. And the top, the at least volume-wise, question is how they're going to sort out this starting rotation. The Brewers sneakily were very good, had very good starting pitching down the stretch last season, August and September. They were as good or better than teams like the Cubs and Nationals that had those top rotations throughout the season. It was a pretty stunning turnaround from the beginning of the year where the Brewers had the worst starting pitching in baseball, and guys like Willie Peralta fell off, was sent down. Taylor Youngman fell off and was sent down. They finished very strong, and now they've got all those players back, plus a newcomer in a Tommy Malone who they brought in on sort of a non-guaranteed flyer-type contract. They've got some prospects who are getting close to the big leagues, especially Josh Hader, who's considered their top pitching prospect. He finished last year at AAA, so that puts him right on the cusp of the big leagues. So they've got basically too many bodies for, you know, the five-man opening day rotation. And the question I get from fans, and this happens every year, is how is that five-man rotation going to flush out? And David Stearns and Craig Counsell told us last spring, and they're telling us again now, that that's the wrong question to ask, because if you look around the game, basically no teams get through a season with five starters. I think last year the Brewers used nine different starting pitchers. That sounds about right. I think eight is about the average for a team. And there have been years where the Brewers have gotten up into double digits. So they're looking at this as more of a large group, and they like the depth that they have. And we'll see if they retain all those guys. They are getting some calls on their starting pitchers as teams look to acquire contending teams. And the Brewers are in a position where they could trade one of these guys if they choose. But they also have a lot of flexibility to go into camp with too many guys for too few spots. And David Stearns has said many times he's perfectly happy to do that and figure it out as spring training goes along.
Yeah, I know that, you know, David Stearns, as you said, and Craig Counsell, this is a good situation to be in where you've got guys competing, as you said, too many bodies for too few spots in that rotation. With that said, Adam, is there anybody in this mix, whether it's Davies, whether it's Guerra, that you can absolutely pinpoint right now as a mortal lock to be a starter in that rotation come opening day in 2017? Or is it so wide open that you really can't pinpoint any one guy and say he is absolutely going to be in that rotation?
Well, I think Zach Davies is going to be in that rotation. I don't see them trading Zach Davies. He's 23 years old. He's kind of in the style of Kyle Hendricks. And he looks like he's a guy you can sort of develop around. So I don't see him getting traded. He's in there. And I think Jimmy Nelson is close to a lock. Look, Brewers fans were really disappointed in Jimmy Nelson's performance down the stretch last year. Jimmy Nelson was very disappointed in his own performance. He has the stuff to be really good in the major leagues, and it hasn't happened for him yet. But this happens with pitchers. Jake Arrieta is like everybody's prime example of a guy with great stuff who took a long time, longer than fans in Baltimore wanted to put it together. So I don't think that they're just all of a sudden going to give up on Jimmy Nelson. In fact, David Stearns was even asked, because of the large number of bodies that they have for these starting spots, would they consider Jimmy Nelson in the bullpen because that's a need of this team right now? And the answer was unequivocally no, that Jimmy Nelson's a starting pitcher and he's going to be back as a starting pitcher. So I think he's the other guy. You know, Junior Guerra, performance-wise, if he's in a Brewers uniform, he's a lock to be in the rotation. He was really good last year, and it didn't, you know, this is good raw stuff. It's upper 90s with that good split. It's not smoke and mirrors. The question is he a potential trade chip? And when, you know, let's say Chris Archer gets traded and some of the other more notable potential trade chips get dealt or stay put, I think teams could turn to a guy like Junior Guerra as an option. So I think, you know, they do. The key to this whole thing from Milwaukee's point of view is this is not just too many bodies for five spots, and they're just that, bodies. They feel like they've got some talented arms there that are potential guys to build around. And I think it starts with Davies and Nelson.
Now, Adam, shifting gears a little bit, one thing I found interesting in a recent article of yours was that David Stearns has been reluctant, the past year or two, to kind of put a timetable on this entire rebuilding effort. Now, on one hand, I completely understand why, because it's a no-win situation if you come out and say, yeah, we'll contend this year, or no, we're not going to contend this year, it's going to take another year or two. That's something a GM never wants to say in front of a hot mic. You know, at the same time, though, can that position or lack thereof kind of be frustrating for the fan base because, again, they're fans, and they want some sort of clarification as to when they can expect to be cheering for a contender? Again, I understand, you know, both sides of the coin here, but where do you kind of fall on this?
Well, I think that the most important thing that it started with Mark Hastanasio and really with Doug Melvin did was to not try to label what they're doing as anything other than a rebuild. They were pretty straightforward from the first day of this. It began with firing Ron Reneke and moving Craig Counsell into the manager's seat, that they were going to take a number of years to rebuild this farm system that they had depleted in particular the 2011 run that they made. And they asked for patience from the start. So I don't think that there are people clamoring for a timetable of when this is going to happen. One of the questions that I put in a story about 2017, some of the issues this team faces, is this the year that they turn the corner in their rebuild? Their rebuild's been a little bit different from the teams that really, the most recent examples, the Cubs and the Astros. You know, those teams lost 100 games. They really bottomed out. This Brewers team hasn't really done that. It's been a little bit different process for them. They were better than expected last year. So the thought, and you know, this was kind of the thought from the beginning, because they got a head start under their previous GM who made some of the big trades that began this rebuild, perhaps this could be a shorter process than other clubs. So I think it's a little different than the Cubs and Astros. Those were about 5 years. Perhaps the Brewers could do it in four. And in that case, you'd like to see further development in 2017 from some of these guys you've identified as core players. I think Jonathan Villar is in that group. You'd like to see their center fielder, Keon Broxton, be in that group. Some of the pitchers we talked about, starting with Zach Davies, you'd like to see take another step forward. And if that happens, I think you could start to look at the Brewers as a club that in 2018 could be an interesting team. Financially, they're in a good spot to add when the time is right. And if they can hit on some of these young guys that they've brought in, like they did with, say, a Johnny Villar, I think that this could be a club that in 2018 at least is, you know, threatens in the division and then becomes interesting after that. The only timetable that they've thrown out there, I'll just throw this out to end this thought, is they signed Craig Counsell to this contract's extension, and it goes through 2020. So automatically everyone puts 2020 as this, you know, here's their window now to win with Craig Counsell as manager. That's the closest that there has been to a concrete time frame. And I think certainly by 2020, they'd like to be a competitive team again.
Now, Adam, at the risk of sounding completely ridiculous, but I'll throw this out there anyway. You mentioned, you know, the Cubs and the Astros and how for a number of years they both really bottomed out. We're talking triple-digit losses. And, you know, now they're reaping the benefits of that entire teardown. The Cubs obviously on top of the world. The Astros could get there fairly soon. Is there a fear, I guess, among some Brewers fans that unless the Brewers really bottom out and unless they have a season where it's 100-plus losses and they really, you know, really tear this thing down to the ground to build it back up, that the team is really not going to achieve the heights of the Cubs or even the Astros, and that maybe their ceiling is slightly something above mediocrity, again, unless they completely tear it down and completely rebuild from the ground up and maybe suffer a season of 100-plus losses. Again, I know that sounds kind of ridiculous because who wants to suffer through that, but do you kind of get what I'm saying here?
Well, yeah, this is the tanking discussion. Is it wise to tank and really try to lose a bunch of games and get a high draft pick? But I'll give you the argument against that. It's hard to do in baseball, number one. Number two, there just aren't the guarantees in the baseball draft, you know, if you're drafting first or second, that you have in other sports. So bottoming out and losing doesn't guarantee you a Chris Bryant. And that's one of the troubles here. So the Brewers are they're drafting ninth this year, for example. Now, I mean, you can make the argument that it would have been better for them to lose more games in 2016. They finished fourth. They never were close to, you know, contending. You can make the argument that they would have been wise to lose more games and get a really high pick. But look, they're just going to have to draft smarter at that position. They're going to have to hit, like every team, they're going to have to hit on their picks where they pick, and you still can't get good players at nine. I think Javi Baez was a ninth overall pick. You just need to really you need to really hit on those selections because they're few and far between. And I don't see the Brewers being worse in 2017 than they were, significantly worse. So they're probably going to be in the same range again next year. And it's just incumbent now on their new scouting director, Todd Johnson. He's a more analytical approach, video, advanced metrics, and all those things are going to be more in play on the amateur side, just as it is now for Milwaukee on the pro side in terms of scouting. And it's on them to make wise decisions.
And that's why drafting, not that it's never been important, but I think it takes on added importance these days, especially when there's so much stock put into, you know, farm hands and their potential, and whether it's guys coming up through your system that can contribute to a rebuild or guys that you could trade at some point to bring in an established star. Drafting, I think, has never been more important than it is these days, certainly. Adam, to begin to wrap up here, of the new players that the team has acquired, you're talking about guys like Eric Thames coming back from overseas after a few successful years over there. You mentioned Tommy Malone, Travis Shaw also in the trade with the Red Sox. Of those guys, who have you had the chance to speak with, and what have been your takeaways from them?
Well, we got to speak pretty extensively with Eric Thames because he came into Milwaukee, and Travis Shaw we spoke to after the Brewers made that trade. I haven't had a chance to speak with Tommy Malone yet. But with Shaw and Thames, really, I think the takeaway is opportunity. For Thames especially, I mean, this is a guy who spent the last 3 years in South Korea putting up crazy numbers. He knows the challenge ahead in terms of coming back to Major League Baseball, facing a higher level of pitching, and basically proving that he is a better player than he was the last time he swung a bat in a Major League game. That he has just developed as a player and a person since that time. So he has a huge opportunity ahead of him, and it comes with a little bit of security of a three-year deal with Milwaukee. I think he's very thankful for this opportunity, and it's a good fit in that it's a team in a position that it's able to give a chance to a guy making a pretty intriguing comeback. And then to a lesser extent, I think the same can be said for Travis Shaw. You know, he's in Boston. You know, there's the question of what is going to happen with Pablo Sandoval. And Travis Shaw potentially could have found himself being on the bench a lot. In Milwaukee, gets to come in and basically be the third baseman from day one. And it's an opportunity for him. Another player who is still somewhat a developing player, certainly not a finished product. He's going to have to prove that he can hit left-handed pitching. That's been, he felt he was successful at that in a small sample early. Then his opportunities dwindled. He began to struggle a little bit more. In Milwaukee, he should get the bulk of these at-bats, and he's going to get a chance to show that he can be an everyday player. That's the benefit of being a rebuilding team in terms of acquiring players, is you can offer them opportunity. And Jonathan Villar is the perfect example of this, a guy who in Houston was kind of a role player off the bench, played all over the place. In Milwaukee, he gets to play every day, and he has a career year. And all of a sudden, he's a player who you're, you know, not building around your franchise, but he's one of the core guys now who's going to be here likely for a long period of time and perhaps see the backside of this rebuild. That's the aim for guys like Eric Thames and Travis Shaw, and they're going to be able to look right there on the infield at a player who was able to grab that opportunity.
And speaking of Jonathan Villar, did he recently steal home in the Dominican Republic? Did I read that?
In just, you know, the highlight of the video for me was the uniforms down there are just sensational.
They are.
And I've talked to him about stealing home. He has not done that in the big league.
Has he attempted?
But he has had multiple steals of home in some of his minor league seasons. And I talked to him last year kind of about that skill and being allowed to turn loose. So that skill is in his back pocket, and perhaps we will see it next year. Steal of home is a great play, and I can't remember the last time I saw it in the big leagues.
I know the Padres of all teams pulled it off a couple of times last year. Travis Jankowski, I think, stole home maybe twice. Somebody else comes to mind, but he's the one that sticks out to me. I was going to ask, Adam, has he attempted a steal of home as a major leaguer?
He has a steal of home as a major leaguer. He has at least one against Andy Pettitte that I know of.
Wow.
I'd have to go back and look at my story again, but he's done it in the big leagues.
Oh, okay.
I do know that in the minor leagues, he's had multiple. Mm. You know, he's done it multiple times.
Something we hope to see in 2017, along with a few more W's for the Brew Crew as we gear up for a brand new season. Good place to wrap this one up. Adam McKelvey, our thanks to you as always. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Milwaukee Brewers. For the first time in 2017, we're talking Reds baseball with our Reds reporter, Mark Sheldon. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us. And good timing with the Reds giving us some actual news to discuss the podcast today, which we're doing here on Wednesday, the 4th of the new year. And Mark, the Reds signing Drew Storen on Tuesday at one time a very effective closer for the Nationals. But he did struggle with the Blue Jays last season, but kind of seemed to rediscover his way when he was traded to the Mariners. 18 appearances, I believe, in the ERA in the low three. So he definitely got back to the pitcher that we're used to him being. What kind of a role do you see for him in this Reds bullpen for 2017?
Well, it remains to be seen. He obviously has the closer experience, but they're not necessarily looking for a specific closer. They have Iglesias, they have Lorenz, and they have Cingrani. Brian Price has been talking about being innovative with his bullpen and maybe having guys go multiple innings and using less appearances but getting more out of them. So you might see a different closer on a different day depending on how much they're used. obviously he could close. It's all going to be determined at spring training. You know, the price tag at 1 year and $3 million plus incentives makes this a low-risk move, and if he doesn't work out, it won't be a huge glut on the payroll. It's still a lot of money, but if he ends up closing and is effective, it's a steal, and or if he sets up and he's effective, it's a steal. So they'll see what happens. He's got the track record of keeping his walks down and keeping the home runs down, which were two major problems for the bullpen last season, and then they hope that he can find it again. He wasn't very successful setting up in either Washington or Toronto, but if he ends up setting up in Cincinnati, maybe he'll be a little bit better.
Yeah, I know that he was really going strong in Washington before the team acquired Jonathan Papelbon, and then Storen got bumped to the setup role, and he did not take to that very well. He gets shipped out of Washington, ends up in Toronto. That was a disaster, but as we said, with Seattle in the latter half of 2016, he really got back to the pitcher he was. I know, though, that you also wrote that something somewhat concerning regarding Drew Storen is that his fastball velocity has been somewhat down over the last season or two. He's never been a flamethrower, but right. There has been a significant change. So in light of that, what makes the Reds convinced that despite the fastball velocity decrease, that he could still be effective for the Reds here?
Well, he used to throw 94 to 96 in his salad days when he was, you know, saving 43 games for Washington. Now, in the last season, it was 91 to 93. Those fastballs also got hit a lot. You know, opponents had a 337 average and 568 slugging percentage when he threw either four-seamers or sinkers last season. But what they kind of see is they looked at the numbers, and they feel like his stuff still plays pretty well. He's got a three-pitch mix. They felt like he still could be effective. You know, Karin DeStoren, you know, he worked a lot last season in low leverage situations, and maybe freely admitted it's harder to get the gasoline going a little bit when it's not a key situation. You know, you get a little, you know, relievers rely on not just the crowd, and they also rely on the atmosphere and the adrenaline of high leverage. So they're hoping maybe more high leverage situations means higher velocity, and he can get his pitches going a little bit. He worked out the last couple of years with Reds catcher Tucker Barnhart. The two are high school teammates way back when in Brownsburg, Indiana. And Tucker's been catching with him the last couple of years and had some good things to say about him as well. And maybe that familiarity could help. And Storen talked to Barnhart about the opportunity that was available with the Reds. And it just seems like right now it's a fit for both sides.
Now, Mark, let's play a game of what if here. Let's say that Storen gets some closing opportunities and he takes the bull by the horns and he really becomes a lights out presence in the back end of that bullpen. Is there any consideration at all, let's say again, that Storen is a lights-out guy in the ninth inning, that they would look at Lorenzen or Iglesias or Cingrani and say, you know what, we can afford to make one of these guys a starter once again, or is that not something they'd really entertain at this point?
I don't think they would entertain that with Cingrani or Iglesias, mostly for health reasons. Both of them proved not to be very durable in starting situations. Iglesias has that shoulder issue, which really affected him when they tried to use him as a starter. But I think Lorenzen is a guy who could end up starting again. I don't know if it would be next season or this coming season. He definitely wants to start. He's being a good soldier. He told the team he would do whatever they asked him to do, and he's told me that as well. So if it means going to the bullpen, that's fine. But he does prefer to start, and I'm sure he would welcome the opportunity if that came up. But they also do have a fleet of young starters that are starting to come in, whether it be Robert Stevenson, Cody Reed, Amir Garrett, or others. You know, they'll have to entertain that. I guess it all depends on what happens with those guys and with the other four starters they already have penciled in. So we'll see what happens, but I wouldn't rule anything out.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of options here for Brian Price to play with, especially if Storen can get in there and do what he's done in the past. It would be entertaining to see what Brian Price would do in such a situation, but time will tell. We'll let that sort itself out here as 2017 wears on. And Mark, where, if anywhere, could the Reds go from here now that Storen is in the mix? What else could they do in that bullpen to kind of fortify it?
Dick Williams hasn't ruled out making other bullpen additions. He said he would keep looking around, and they weren't, you know, done. They would stay busy. There's still some time left in the offseason. They may not make any more major league contract signings. They could be minor league deals and extended spring training invites. The bullpen, you know, one new reliever does not a bullpen fix necessarily. So they have to keep the eye out for what they would call bargains, guys that, you know, maybe reclamation projects, kind of like Storen, or a guy coming off an injury. There's also needs to supplement the catching depth. They have a Rule 5 pick behind Mesoraco and Tucker Barnhart, but I think they wouldn't mind having a veteran catcher with some experience that could be there in case Mesoraco shows that he's not ready yet. They also could use a starting pitcher to join those young guys I previously mentioned and add some competition to the rotation for that last spot. They also need some bench help, so I wouldn't be shocked if they beat the bushes a little bit to find some low-cost hitters that could help on the bench, maybe an outfielder.
Yeah, still a lot of work to do to prepare for 2017, no question. Mark, shifting gears a little bit, Joey Votto announced recently that he is not going to play for Team Canada in the upcoming World Baseball Classic, which kicks off in March. Now, he had done so for his native country in both 2009 and 2013. So why do you think the decision by him to forego the event this time, unlike the previous two occasions?
I wasn't too surprised that he did it. He kind of hinted that he was going to be spending a lot of his offseason getting better on both sides of his game. He in the past had done a lot of work to get himself ready physically, but he felt maybe he neglected some of his baseball skills. He really took a nosedive defensively, especially. Obviously, his hitting was slow to get started last year. He didn't really get going until June 1st, and he obviously had a good year after that hitting. But I think he really wants to dedicate himself to coming out of the gate prepared for the Reds, showing that the Reds that he's ready. He wants to be better defensively. I also think there might be some logistics stuff involved as well. I mean, I think all of Canada's games are, I believe, at least the first round are in Florida. So that would require cross-country travel from Arizona, where the Reds have spring training, over to Florida. That's asking a lot as well. And I don't believe Canada is suffering from a first base shortage. I believe they have a couple of other first basemen, so they wouldn't necessarily miss Votto as much. Obviously, one of the best hitters in their nation's history. So they would love to have him, and he'll be rooting him on from a distance. But I think knowing what he has to do to be better this season, I don't think playing the WBC was going to fit into those plans.
Yeah, and I think most people would agree, as you wrote, he hit barely over 200 on the first month or two of the season. The defense all season was a problem. He got insanely hot after the All-Star break, and hopefully he can carry that momentum into the new season without having to worry about the duties of the World Baseball Classic 2. Mark, to wrap up here, there's been some moving and shaking in the front office as of late. Most notably, Dick Williams has taken on the title of President of Baseball Operations in addition to his customary GM duties, as Williams inherits his new post from Walt Jocketty, who was named the executive advisor to the Red CEO. So, Mark, in layman's terms, what does this all mean? What in addition to the GM duties will Dick Williams be doing now that he's taken on this new role as the president of baseball operations?
To be perfectly blunt, in layman's terms, this doesn't really change anything. he's not going to take on any additional responsibilities. When Walt Jocketty was GM, except for last year, he was also the president of baseball operations. It's a title that basically signifies that Dick is in charge of the entire baseball operations department, like he was anyway after Walt stepped aside. So there really is no, as far as the functioning of the front office goes, there's really no major change. Walt's going to be advising both Dick and Bob Castellini, a couple of scouts that have been with the organization for a long time, Sean Pender and Terry Reynolds, move into special assistant roles, while longtime special assistant Jerry Walker retired. And then, of course, a lot of guys were just named as vice presidents that hadn't had that title before, whether it was in media relations with Rob Butcher, whether it was traveling with Gary Wehoff, whether it was the clubhouse manager Rick Stowe, Chris Buckley, the senior scouting director of amateur scouting. So there's a lot of just different guys that have been adding the vice president term, including both the assistant GM, Sam Grossman, and Nick Kroll. I think it's just a decision they made to give some guys promotions that have been with the organization a long time, and also to signify that Dick Williams is indeed in charge. I would not be shocked if in a few years down the road, maybe he gives up the GM part and just stays as president, and like a lot of clubs are doing, and they hire a GM to kind of take care of the things like negotiations and contracts, dealing with the media and agents like that. I mean, Dick's done a pretty good job and so far in dealing with all that, it seems like, from my point of view, but it is a big job now. It does seem to be a two-headed monster in a lot of organizations, and I would not be surprised if the Reds eventually go that way too.
Great stuff as always from Mark Sheldon today, and I want to point out to our listeners that Mark is trooping through, if trooping's a word, An ailing tooth. But Mark, we've got some Novocaine in there, and things are better, I hope.
Yeah, hopefully I'm not flooring too much. you know, if you want to throw on the Mel Torme music like in that Seinfeld episode, that'd be awesome. But now I'm it's almost wearing off. I can almost close my eye. I can't close my eye right now because my whole face is numb. So, we'll get there.
When's that going to wear off? We're talking hours, days. What are we talking here?
Hopefully more like minutes than hours. But okay. It's been an hour already, and I'm still kind of feeling it. So we'll see if I can get the wear off by dinner time.
I hope so, for your sake, of course. And I think I speak for everybody when I say that nobody could tell that you were, ailing through this podcast. So a job well done, and Mel Torme especially is proud of you. Mark, thanks so much for the time. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras Cincinnati Reds. For the first time in 2017 on this, the fourth day of the new year, we're talking Cubs baseball today with Kerry Muscat. Kerry, thank you for the time as always. And Kerry, of course, Cubs fans bid a bittersweet farewell to 2016, a year that changed the lives of Cubs fans forever, for the better, of course, but it's still full speed ahead to a hopeful title defense in 2017. So, Kerry, I want to ask you, I know this is a popular time of year to get questions from fans in the inbox, and with that in mind, what is the most popular question or concern that you're hearing from Cubs fans as they hope for back-to-back titles in 2017?
Well, there's actually been two topics of concern. One is whether or not the team has enough starting pitching. And then the second one is who's going to lead off with now that Dexter Fowler has left and joined the Cardinals. As far as the starting pitching goes, I can understand the Cubs fans' concern a little bit because last year they started and they had Adam Warren and Trevor Cahill and Travis Wood were sort of projected as insurance. They all wound up in the bullpen, but they were projected as being backups just in case they needed an extra starter. I'm not sure that the names of the pitchers that are projected for that this year are names that any Cubs fans, not too many Cubs fans know. So it's we're talking Rob Sestrinski and Jake Buchanan, Aaron Brooks, and Seth Frankoff, who are all projected to start the season at Triple A Iowa, but they could get starts, if needed. Of course, you're always hoping that you can ride your five starters for the rest of the year, but they could be guys to watch in spring training just to see them get stretched out a little bit and see them get some action. As far as leadoff guy, I'm sure it's going to be a hot topic at the Cubs convention, which is coming up. Joe Maddon has tossed out Kyle Schwarber's name, which isn't a bad option. Of course, players like to tell you they only lead off once. Schwarber is the type of guy that can get on base, and he might be the guy. So we'll just have to see on that one.
And, Kerry, going back to the pitching end of the equation, are you – I know we've covered this, before, as during the winter meetings and such, but given the concerns about the pitching staff and, the lack of depth at the back end of that rotation and with Mike Montgomery being relied upon to be that fifth starter, are you a bit surprised that the Cubs did not make more of an effort to retain Jason Hamill? I know that he did not pitch in the postseason. He did win 15 games. Maybe the peripheral numbers aren't as great as the 15 wins may suggest, but still, nonetheless, are you a bit surprised that they kind of let him go so easily?
Yes and no. I think part of it is I really like Jason Hamill as a person, and I know how much he enjoyed being with the Cubs and being on the Cubs staff. So on a personal note, I was surprised. From just a business standpoint, I think the Cubs feel that they were doing Jason a favor because the starting pitching market was so thin that this way he would have a chance to get a better deal from another team. So that was part of their motivation. And they honestly feel that they have enough depth. They also feel that they're going to find another starter someplace, somewhere, somehow. So I think that Hamill, again, they met with him, they talked to him. I think he understood what they were doing. The Cubs front office said that the discussion went well. I even talked to Hamill's agent, and they felt that really the Cubs did him a favor by letting him go, he can get a bet. He might be able to get more money and get a bet, more security from another team.
Yeah, that's a good point. And like you said, when you like somebody on a personal level, it's even tougher, you know, to see them go, as is the case with Jason Hamill. I find it a bit surprising that he has not been scooped up yet. We saw Ivan Nova go back to the Pirates for a pretty reasonable deal, 3 years and $26 million. I'm not quite sure what kind of numbers Hamill would command, but I think that he could be a steal for the other 29 teams out there. We'll see what becomes of his future. So, Kerry, you brought up, kind of the two main concerns on the minds of the fans with, the pitching depth at the back end and who leads off. You brought up the kind of the outside-the-box thinking of Kyle Schwarber at the top of that lineup, possibly. In your mind, are those the two biggest areas of concern, or is there something else lingering right now that you think might be as concerning as those two issues?
Well, considering the team won 103 games last year, there aren't too many things to worry about, because they've got pretty much the same roster with everybody coming back, with the exception of Fowler and Hamill. The pitching is always a concern. I know I've had emails from some fans who are already in panic mode, thinking that this is going to be like the 1985 season when all the Cubs starting pitching went down. I'm not in panic mode. I'm just not sure that they have the depth that they had at the start of 2016. I mean, Travis Wood, Trevor Cahill, and Adam Warren were options and were decent options. They don't have those three pitchers. And the four that I mentioned that are projected for Iowa's rotation, they're young. Zastrzyzny had a great made a great first impression. You just can never have enough pitching, and I'm just not sure that they have enough.
Yeah, I mean, and that rings so true, even for a team like you said that won triple-digit games, obviously won the World Series, and yet they have as many, concerns and what-ifs as almost any other team out there because, as you said, and everybody would agree, you can never, ever have enough pitching, especially these days with the way the game is played. Kerry, shifting gears a little bit, something we did not get around to discussing before the holidays, but Jason Hayward appears to be taking some extra steps to bounce back from a disappointing offensive season in 2016. He's as good defensively as he's ever been, if not better. But I know that you wrote that he's doing some extra work in Arizona and doing not only more physical work, but some mental work as well, perhaps, or working with a mental coach. Kind of explain that and explain, what he's doing to get back to hitting the way that we know he can.
I don't think I wrote that. I think what it was that the mental skills coach is the one who posted the photos of Jason during his workouts. They're good friends down there. What I found interesting with Jason Hayward is that he actually moved and bought a home in the Phoenix area so that he's closer to the Cubs facility. And this will enable him to go over there and work out. And he worked with, got a head start right before Christmas with John Maley, the Cubs hitting coach, and also with Eric Kinski, the assistant hitting coach, and was over in Mesa doing some drills. And it's just baby steps, it's first steps. I found some of the fan reaction really comical. I mean, fans were already doing breakdowns on his swing and what he was changing. And I give the guy a break. He's trying to get back to where he was when he was successful. Give him a chance to work on this. Give him some time. It's great that the players have this kind of time and have the facilities available to them and don't have to worry about whether or not they have to come up to the plate and drive in the game-winning hit, and do something like that. The fan reaction just strikes me as very funny. Let's take a deep breath. Jason Hayward is a really good ball player. His numbers were not a fluke. I think that if people would just be patient, they're going to see the guy that hit 293, the guy that hit, double-digit home runs. I think it'll all happen. We just need to give him some space.
Yeah, let the guy breathe, right?
Yeah.
I know that Theo Epstein had some very telling comments, and one thing that he said that struck me was that it's almost impossible for any athlete to make wholesale mechanical changes during the course of a season. I think that gets lost on a lot of fans. You know, you have your hot streaks, your cold streaks, but to make wholesale changes, extremely difficult in the day-to-day grind of a baseball season. Now it's the offseason, obviously. He can make these changes and get back to being the player that we know that he can be. And hopefully good things in store for Jason Heyward in 2017. Kerry, have to wrap up with a great story. Explain to those who might not be aware who Joe Cubby Hubby Mendoza is. I love the nickname and why he just might have the coolest, most understanding wife in the world. This is a great story.
Well, apparently Joe had told his fiance Amy that if the Cubs won the World Series, that he wanted to get a Cubs tattoo. And apparently Amy said no. So she compromised, and she allowed him to wear a full Cubs uniform on their wedding day. And the couple got married in Las Vegas, naturally, and he had a full Cubs uni on, number 16 on the back for the year 2016. It also said Cubby Hubby, which I'm not sure I would have gone out in public with, but that's okay. And she was dressed beautifully from the photos, but she went along with this. They got married. He also had a W towel from Game 5 of the World Series tucked into his back pocket. She had given him tickets for that game at Wrigley Field. They live in Los Angeles, and they sent me some other photos, which I did not post. One included an Elvis impersonator at their wedding, and they also took a photo of themselves in front of the Paris night casino down in Vegas. So I give Amy a lot of credit for being a good sport. I know that Joe's very happy. He was tickled by the story and the, seeing his photo up on the Cubs site. But I've heard a lot of Cubs decorated cakes at weddings after the World Series win. You know, people that have passed away have been had Cubs memorabilia in their caskets. It's quite 2016 is a year that Cubs fans are not going to forget, and they're going to continue to celebrate probably long into 2017.
As well they should. And to have the Elvis impersonator at a Las Vegas wedding, that's icing on the literal wedding cake right there. Great story to wrap things up. Kerry Muscat, thank you for the time as always. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago Cubs.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.